This is James Corbett of The Corbett Report coming to you on the 14th of April, 2011 here in Japan. And today I'm talking to Jeff Rook, Director of Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, a national alliance of local, state, and federal resource professionals. He has served in the California state government and was formerly a staff attorney and policy director at the Government Accountability Project. Mr. Rook, thank you very much for joining us today on The Corbett Report.
I'm happy to be here.
Well, today I'm looking at a press release from the Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility website at peer.org, and it's dated April 5th, 2010, entitled Radiation Exposure Debate Rages Inside EPA. And the first line of this press release reads, "A plan awaiting approval by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency that would dramatically increase permissible radioactive releases in drinking water, food, and soil after radiological incidents is drawing vigorous objections from agency experts, according to agency documents released today by Peer." Can you tell us more about this story from over a year ago now and why it's important?
Well, let me sort of start at the beginning, which was what's at stake are the guidance for how public agencies in the United States, the federal and state level, respond to radiological incidents, reactor mishaps, spills, even a dirty bomb attack. And our current guides were written in 1992. And during the Bush administration, there was a desire to basically update them to reflect the 9/11 experience, particularly the prospects of a dirty bomb attack in the continental United States. So that started an effort to basically update the PAGs, as they're called, Protective Action Guides. And at the very tail end of the administration, a package emerged that substantially relaxed, in some cases by hundreds and in a few cases by many thousandfold, the standard for public exposure following these events. These guides were about to go into the Federal Register, and because they're not regulations, they're basically just tips as to EPA and its partner agencies as to how they're supposed to interpret various pollution laws. Once they were published, they go into effect. So there was a bigger struggle in which we were involved that helped prevent these PAGs from going into effect in literally the final hours of the Bush administration. And the new Obama appointees or designates sort of weighed in to say they wanted to take another look. Shortly thereafter, after the inauguration of Barack Obama, who pledged transparency, we submitted a public records request under the Freedom of Information Act to EPA because we'd been informed by employees that there was serious disagreement within the agency, particularly on issues such as how much contamination of water would be allowed for public consumption, what level of contamination in the soil and for how long. And there were also controversies about the level of radionuclides that would be allowed in food that would be declared fit for consumption. Significantly, the agency didn't respond to our request, and we had to sue them. And from that suit, we produced several cases of documents. The clearest individual documents were the ones that we displayed in the press release in April of 2010, where various people from the EPA Water Program, Superfund Program, and even their Office of General Counsel expressed deep reservations about the direction and the rigor of these PAGs. So that's what's reflected in that release.
So then, just to be clear, these PAGs are applying only to permissible radiation releases after radiological incidents. So would that include reactors going off in Japan or incidents like that?
At the moment, that would be example A.
Absolutely. Well, very interesting. So bring us up to date then about more recent developments on this issue.
So it was our understanding, and there was also a significant pushback from other environmental organizations, that EPA agreed to rethink these concerns. And that fall of 2010, we were contacted by a firm that was hired by EPA to assess stakeholder concerns in order to develop a communications plan for EPA. And while the firm itself was approaching us in a fairly straightforward manner, what we understood their task to be was to kind of massage opposition, to basically give EPA guidance for how they could proceed with the previous plan in a way that raised fewer objections. And so this stakeholder survey asked a number of questions that seemed to be premised on the notion that the only problem here was EPA's failure to clearly communicate, not the substance of what it was they were doing. So we did subsequent Freedom of Information Act requests, which were answered, I think in large part because we had had to sue them before. And what we uncovered earlier this year were documents indicating that in mid-2010, a decision had been made by the administrator of EPA to go ahead and approve the final package. And there were also documents from the consultant firm outlining what they had been told by EPA, that in essence the earlier Bush package was what was moving forward, that some items might be taken out of it, but nothing would be added to it. But despite an expressed need to be clear with affected organizations and individuals, the details of what EPA is planning to do has not come forward. And so the last communication we had from them, which was late in March of 2011, was they're still saying no final decision has been made, even though there's email traffic that says indeed the decision to go forward had been made. And so we're not exactly sure what is going on, and we also don't know whether or not events in Japan may have affected or delayed what EPA was planning to do.
Well, very interesting. And on a more recent note, you have environmentalists allege EPA has planned to raise acceptable post-Japanese accident levels for food and water posted on your site. It's a link to huntingtonnews.net, and it's talking about the maximum contamination limits under the Safe Drinking Water Act that are being raised being proposed to be raised by a factor of 100,000 in two instances, 7 million times. And it also says there is nothing to prevent these levels from being the final cleanup achieved, i.e. it's not confined to immediate responsive emergency phase. So at the moment, it's up in the air as to whether this is proceeding or how it's proceeding. But so what do you think will be the next stage in which we'll find out what's happening behind the scenes here?
I'm not sure. I know that there are now members of Congress that have been stimulated to ask questions, and even some of the rainfall samples that are being collected by EPA and reported suggest that rainfalling both on the west and east coast of the United States have radionuclides that are much higher than the maximum contamination level under the Clean Water Act. EPA won't identify exactly which elements those are, where those samples were taken, and exactly how much over the MCL, the maximum limit, they are. But it does have a public statement on their website saying, well, that maximum contamination limit is based upon a lifetime of exposure, and it's only going to rain a few days, so in essence, don't worry, be happy. And while that's technically true, it's misleading in that under the Clean Water Act, those limits could only be exceeded for a few days. And it can rain for more than a few days, but it also raises larger questions about the amount of radionuclides that are falling on the U.S. in rain and where they're coming from and what does it all mean. So we have another FOIA into EPA to get basically all of that reporting data so it can be openly displayed without interpretation.
Well, indeed, it does seem there's quite a bit of interpretation and ambiguity going on here, and people don't even know what's being measured or why if there's any standard for how much can be within a single day's rainwater, or if it's only if it applies throughout a year's worth of contamination. Or it seems all that there's levels of interpretation happening here that doesn't seem very comforting to the public.
No, and the other thing that it's also clear from the materials that we've displayed is that there are a range of decisions within EPA. So the decisions that we uncovered, the communications we uncovered, were EPA's own subject matter experts on air and soil vigorously objecting to what EPA's radiological arm was doing. And so EPA is not a single entity. It's sort of a complex community with internal factions. And in the face of that kind of disagreement, what a bureaucracy will tend to do is to put out vague statements that just sort of paper over everything in the hopes that one day when they clarify what their stance will be, they can be a little more candid.
Well, that's right. I think it's important for listeners out there to understand that the EPA and other such agencies are not monolithic organizations, and that there is often internal disputes on things like this. And my listeners might be familiar with the internal disputes that have taken place over fluoridation levels and things of that nature
right.
before. So
and
definitely.
The nature of our organization with the Public Employees for Environmental Responsibilities, we work with employees inside the agencies in many instances to figure out safe ways for their internal dissent to reach their true employers, the public, with them being able to continue their career without retaliation.
So to be clear, you've referred to the internal emails about the debate over radiation levels. Have you published those on the website or not?
Yes, they're the attachments to the April 2010 release.
Right, I see. Okay. All right. Well, I will, of course, put links in the documentation for today's interview so people can get that directly from my website, links to the peer.org website and the articles in question. But I guess in closing, for the average person out there who is not, you know, obviously in the EPA, what can they do to help bring pressure on this issue and bring public scrutiny to this?
This is going to sound trite, but in this case I think it's quite effective, which is they should write their local, their member of Congress, and ask him or her to get to the bottom of what the government response is going to be. These kind of issues are beyond partisanship, and unless the post-event protections are made understandable to the average citizen, they're not going to be very effective in any event. So this is a place where Congress could really, with hands across the aisle, do everyone a service.
All right. Well, just in closing then, can you tell us about the Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility website and what people can find there?
We are peer.org, www.peer.org, and they can find information like this on a variety of topics. You can look by agency, and so you can see a lot of things that are going on in EPA on this issue and many other issues. You can look state by state, and we have a number of cross-cutting campaigns that relate from everything to extensive use of coal ash in the United States without any kind of risk assessment to a variety of wildlife and other sort of environmental issues.
All right, excellent. Well, thank you very much for joining us today, Jeff Rook, and best of luck in all of your future work.
Thank you.